The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
We have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Monday Space Show. Thank you for tuning in. Be here. Let me tell you about today's program. But first, 866-687-7223. I will tell you when it's available. Right now, it's not available. I want our guest to be able to put forth his thesis for the discussion today, and I'll tell you when we open that line up. Again, 1-866-687-7223. Email, of course, is drspace@thespaceshow.com, and let's just stick with that one for simplicity for today. Please do remember that we're trademarked and copyrighted. You do have permission to download shows and share them and pass them around. Please don't do any editing of the program and don't do anything commercial with the program. We're podcasting on a number of sources. We thank Gigadial.net for our podcasting service. And you can find us on iTunes, Microsoft Zoom, Podcast Alley, astrospacenow.com, yastro.com, and of course our parent podcasting company, gigadial.com or gigadial.net. If you have any problems with our podcast, do let me hear from you at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then, also remember that we are at the website, thespaceshow.com. So everything we do is archived and has been archived since 2001. And this show is number 1,528. So you can hear all of these shows off of our website. You can also download these shows. And if you have any questions on how to do that, fire off an email to me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Our newsletter is there as well on the website. You can't possibly miss it. The website newsletter has all of the details of the week's programming, all of the guest bios, the future events section, all of that. So do check it from time to time, because if we have to change programming or make any announcements, that's where you're going to see it first. And then you can, of course, subscribe to the very short email newsletter that goes out Monday morning, California time. Just send your request to drspace@thespaceshow.com. Note, we have a store on our website. It's up near the top. It's listed as Space Show Gear. Do visit it and check it out. And then also, we are a 501c3 nonprofit with the OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. You'll see our PayPal contribution links on both websites. And remember, we can't do this program without your financial support. We appreciate those who do support us. Remember, if you pay United States taxes, you do get a tax deduction. If you pay California taxes, you also get a California deduction. Do remember that the Space Show is brought to you in part by the Secure World Foundation, promoting cooperative solutions for space security. For more information, please do visit their website, secureworldfoundation.org. And then finally, one quick note, do comment on our programs. Check them out. And you can do that at our blog, which is thespaceshow.wordpress.com. And we look forward to your comments. So I'm really happy to bring back my good friend and a really excellent, outstanding Space Show guest, but also space researcher, Dr. William Rowe. This is the first part of a very special 3-part series that Bill is going to do for the Space Show. And I'll let him tell you about that in a few minutes. But he is a board-certified internal medicine doc, and he specialized in the work of the cardiovascular system and advantages of young women in space. He is the author of many peer as well as non-peer-reviewed articles on space and related topics. He is a specialist in gender differences for astronaut selection, human physiology in space, and when best to do spacewalks, and a lot more. His website, which you should open up and follow during this program, because all of you are listening to it on the internet, so there's no reason why you can't be at his website, because we are going to be talking about things on his website, www.femsinspace.com, FemsInspace.com. So rather than continuing to talk about Dr. Rowe, welcome back to the Space Show. How are you, Bill?
Just fine, David. Glad to be on and looking forward to it.
Okay. So giving listeners a moment to go to your website again, femsinspace.com. Let's start out, and there's a lot of issues I know that you're going to be talking about today, but going to Mars is always of great interest, so let's jump in right here. What is needed to select a candidate for a Mars trip?
Well, suppose someone wants to go to Mars. The first thing to keep in mind is that the round trip would be estimated to be about 2 years. Even if we go nuclear, which would be about 3 months each way, with plasma propulsion, it would be perhaps 6 months each way. But then you have to wait for a close alignment between Mars and the Earth, so that a round trip would be about 2 years. Now, there is no experience beyond 438 days. One Russian was up 438 days, and by the way, when I gave a paper in Santorini Island in Greece, someone pointed him out to me. But it's interesting to use that as a background. After 5 months in space, this Russian demonstrated that his vessel dilators were no longer detectable. There were two vessel dilators that were not detectable after 5 months in space and did not return to levels which could be detected until 3 months after return from after a 438-day mission. So a Mars mission would be, 600 days, and there is no experience with that. All right, well, let's assume that we're going to select someone who's going to go to Mars. First thing we find out, much to the amazement of all of your listeners, I'm sure, is that if you're over 28, you can't go. Now, I selected 28 because I just got through telling you that it's going to be, at the minimum, a two-year journey. Why can't you go after age 28? Because there is very strong evidence that after the age of 30, the endothelium, which is the lining of the blood vessels, in which I'm going to address for these three sessions, the lining of the blood vessels is... there's an insult to the lining of the blood vessels, and after age, with space, and after age 30, these delicate cells do not repair well. Now, someone might take issue with that, but Van Ute published this in a textbook, about 1997. Van Ute is considered one of the world's experts in vascular disease. I might emphasize this by saying that about a year and a half ago, we had a visiting cardiologist come from California, and I asked this particular cardiologist, who's world-renowned, is it still true today that the lining of the blood vessels is not adequately repaired after age 30? And he said, yes, absolutely, this has been well-documented with experimental animals and using that information in humans, this is so. All right, well, let's go to the next one. Are you a male? And if you are a male and we're selecting you, you've got to be under age 35. Well, now, why is that? Because you have six times greater chance of dying from cardiovascular disease in compared to a female. This is why all the way through my research, the last 18 years, I have pointed out the tremendous advantage of females over males. Males, basically today, are sperm providers. Now, males aren't going to like that statement, but it's true. We no longer need high adrenaline for fight flight. We needed it up until 10,000 years ago, but since then, nature really doesn't give a damn about anything other than preserving the species. And with preservation of the species, that's where the tremendous cardiovascular advantages come into play. And I'm going to emphasize that either today or with the next session. If you're a male in your early 20s, you already have perhaps vascular disease. We know that during the Korean War, men of their early 20s who were killed and with autopsy evidence was found that there was not infrequently an occlusion of one of the three major coronary vessels in young men in their early 20s. Also, in men especially, or males especially, by age 12, blood vessel disease already begins by age 12. The females have an advantage at age 12 because with menstruation they lose iron. They lose 30 to 50 cc's of blood every month, and too much iron is toxic to the circulation, and I'll discuss this later. When you take a shower, do you have trouble seeing your feet? Is your abdomen too big? If your abdomen is too big, there is no way that anyone's going to send you up to Mars. Obviously, that would be absurd. The reason is because the abdomen, the fat in the abdomen, is a manufacturing plant for cytokines. Now, that brings us to my website, and if you would look at the submarine that I have on the on my website, look at the periscope. The periscope is the only thing which protrudes above the surface. Now, make believe that this submarine is going through 60,000 miles of blood vessels in one human being, and that the lining of the blood vessels, which we call the endothelium, that lining covers seven tennis courts in one human being. Just think how complicated it is. And this lining is very, very delicate, and all of us should have perhaps written on our forehead, fragile, handle with care. And when we're discussing the endothelium. Now, let's add another concept here. How physically fit are you if you want to go to Mars? You have the same genes as the Tarahumara Indians, basically, the Navajo, the Bushmen of the Kalahari, and the Aborigines. And all four of those groups have the capability of chasing an animal, an antelope or a deer, for up to 2 days until that antelope drops from exhaustion, and then it's merely throttled, which means choked, and that's the end of it. Now, basically, our genes aren't any different than these people who have been raised and in a physically fit environment, and probably in the last 3, 4, 5 decades, the incidence of physical fitness has diminished appreciably in our society, and along with it, the weight gain has come right along with it. The other problem is, are you taking pharmaceuticals? If you answer yes, then I'm sorry, but you can't go. Now, I have argued this for at least 10 years with many people. I have published several peer-reviewed articles stating the fact that pharmaceuticals cannot be used in space. There are four basic reasons. Number one, there is, in some pharmaceuticals, deterioration. The mechanism is not known. It may be related to radiation. I've discussed this with Dr. Pucha. Dr. Pucha is the head of pharmacology at NASA, and she has been working on this deterioration of some pharmaceuticals for at least the last 2 years. Another problem is the fact that the liver may not function after a certain amount of time. It may be months, it might be a year, it might be longer, and obviously there's going to be a difference with each individual. But obviously the liver depends upon the circulation. The liver is important to metabolize pharmaceuticals. The same problem exists with the kidneys. The kidneys are necessary to excrete the pharmaceuticals, and if they're not adequately excreted and the pharmaceuticals build up, then that's a tremendous problem. So those are basically the reasons that we can't use pharmaceuticals in space, and I have emphasized this repeatedly. Now, if there are any questions, I'll stop right there, and I'll be glad to answer any.
Well, I'm going to turn on the toll-free line right now. So, listeners, that line is open if you want to call in, 1-866-687-7223. And I've got one email question from Joan, who is in Boulder, Colorado. And she said, a few minutes ago, you said nobody over 30 could go to Mars, and then you said men over 35 could not go to Mars. So that seems confusing to me.
Yeah, that is confusing. And the only thing, the only point is that we don't have any data on people under the age of 30. And as I was saying this, I realized that that is going to be a little bit confusing. But there's no data on people under the age of 30. But you know, we're only talking about 5 years difference, and all these figures are somewhat arbitrary. But basically, everybody throughout the world literature accepts the fact that the cardiovascular mortality rate is six times higher in males and females. I'm going to go into all of these things in great detail, or much—I shouldn't say great detail, but in detail. And spell them all out for you as we go on. So a lot of these questions that come up, I'm eventually probably going to answer, but I don't, on the other hand, want to discourage you from asking them if you like.
Okay, and again, you can use the phone line when you want now, listeners, 1-866-687-7223. Let's go ahead, Bill, keep going, because I know we have a lot to cover today.
All right, we certainly do. I want you all to look at that submarine, and as you look at it, realize that the lining of the blood vessels is vulnerable to injury. If you do some studies or look at some studies that were done in rats, remember we share at least 80% of the same genes as rats. So a lot of medical literature is derived from rat studies, a lot of it. If you look at the, take a rat which has been exposed to space for 12 days, 12.5 days actually, and after the rat returns from that 12-day mission, if you sacrifice the rat, you will see when you look at the endothelium, the lining of the blood vessels, small little capillaries, these lines of lining, that there are projections which come from the lining of the blood vessels, and these projections might serve as a source of leaking. We know that in space, the plasma volume is invariably diminished by about 10%, and one of the possible causes might be that because the endothelium isn't intact after 12 days demonstrated in a rat, that this may be a source of leaking of this plasma. This causes all sorts of problems as the vessel constrictors become elevated. the bone marrow is unhappy with the situation of the plasma volume is diminished, so the production of red blood cells is cut off by also 10%, because the body is always compensating.
Well, can't you
another problem? I'll just get through.
Okay.
There are if you take a rat and expose that rat to swimming for 4 hours, and you attach to that rat a weight of 2 to 3%, after just 4 hours, you will get the identical changes in that rat that you do after 12 days in space. And if you take a rat, Godlewski from Harvard has shown that if you take a rat and expose that rat to dust, that the dust exposure will also cause the same identical projections in the endothelium. Now, the dust exposure is very, very interesting, and I'm going to get into that later. It really is, I think, one of the most interesting parts, aspects of space medicine. And it was a problem on the moon because dust was brought into the habitats on the spacesuits, and I'll get into that later. So it shows just with these three situations, which really are all different, what happens to the lining. Let me just say one more point before Dave, before you get into this, David. I wrote a letter to the editor, and I want to keep shifting back and forth between space and Earth, Earth and space, back and forth, and try over these next three sessions to weave in and out concepts which apply both on Earth and in space. I wrote a letter to the editor about 2 months ago, and I live in Charlottesville, Virginia, which was published in our local newspaper about a swimmer who, about age 24 or 25, died over in the Middle East near Dubai last fall, and the temperature of the water was about 86 degrees. He probably died of heat exhaustion. And also, when someone swims, surprisingly, they lose about a liter of sweat per hour. They can lose with very, very intense swimming, as would occur with a world-class athletic event. They can lose a liter of fluid per hour. So what happens is, with very stressful situations, there's a magnesium deficiency because the adrenaline levels are elevated, and the higher the adrenaline, the lower the magnesium. But in addition, there is a potential for a significant decrease in magnesium because of loss of magnesium in the sweat. So basically, I wrote this article saying that the magnesium may tie to this athlete's death. They're going to make a decision this month in March as to what was the cause of this young man's death. But it points up the fact that we can take information, and surprisingly, information that we learn from space can be very similar to what occurs on Earth. I'll stop again, David, and feel free to ask anything you'd like.
I've got questions from listeners. This is Alan in Houston, Texas, and he said, I assume by plasma you're talking about blood plasma. When you use definitions in your show, you should assume that most of us are non-technical with medical, and more clarification would be helpful. If they're losing plasma in long-duration space flight, why can't you just keep transfusing the astronaut?
Well, you cannot do this because if you keep transfusing them, again, suppose we've got a two-year mission to Mars.
A lot of blood
or
plasma,
suppose,
right?
Or suppose we have a mission even of several weeks. If you transfuse them, how are you going to do it? If you go intravenously, there's a risk of penetrating into a vein. There's always the risk of infection, plus the fact that there's invariably decreased magnesium in space, and this increases the potential for infection. If we go subcutaneously and give plasma subcutaneously, guess what? there is absolutely no way at this time to provide anything subcutaneously in space. And since you brought it up, I might as well tell you why now. I have been frustrated about the fact that we can't give pharmaceuticals by mouth, because there's invariably malabsorption. I knew there was a fourth one I was trying to think of. There's invariable malabsorption in space. Malabsorption means that there's impairment in absorption of food and impairment in absorption of any drug that you'd like to give. So whatever is given, you would have to give it parenterally. You can't give it intramuscularly because it would be too painful, and there is no, you can't give it subcutaneously because you can't give it by injection every 4 or 6 hours for 2 months or 2 years. So Santini and Langer from they're in the east in near Boston. They developed a silicon device which is about the size of a pocket watch, which has thousands of little mini compartments to administer various pharmaceuticals, and this can be placed under the skin in either the chest or the abdomen, and would be about the size of a pacemaker. But the problem with, and you could put in anything that you'd like. You could put in magnesium, you could put in potassium, you could put in various drugs that can be given subcutaneously. The problem is that once this device leaves the manufacturer, it cannot be replenished. Therefore, as of right now, March of the 2011, there is no way to give any pharmaceuticals subcutaneously in space. Plus the fact that the pharmaceutical companies are not interested in developing subcutaneous pharmaceuticals because there is no demand. The only demand there would be, basically, would be in space. And at least in the United States, the space program is closing down. So this is a problem that I don't know what the solution is. If you look, I looked into this a few months ago, and I was frustrated to find that the only thing that really basically is used subcutaneously to any great degree is insulin. But I can't find anything else that is basically used this way.
Let me ask you a question.
Let's go, David.
If you were going to give somebody an IV in space, how do you do it in a microgravity situation?
You just would set up an IV.
You'd have to pump it?
I don't think it would be any problem. You're talking about with microgravity.
Yeah, how would it flow?
I guess with you could develop some way of and pushing it.
Pushing it in.
There have been a central venous pressure. Central venous pressure has been measured in space, and that was done in the 90s. And I'm trying to think. That was done in the early 90s where they measured the venous pressure on the central side. It was thought that since there's a shift of fluid to the upper part of the body, that the venous pressure in the central part of the body would be elevated, and lo and behold, they found out that the central venous pressure is not elevated in space. So anyhow, I don't think that would be a great technical problem to give it intravenously with some type of a pump device. Okay, David, where do you want to go from? Have any questions?
Well, yeah, and then this is following up on what was asked before. James is in San Antonio, Texas, and he says, does shelf life of pharmaceuticals play a role if you're going to Mars?
Does it? Oh, I would think certainly. The problem is that I don't know how we're going to give them. I don't know how we're going.
So that's the bigger problem, is the administration of them, not so much the
shelf life. I think that's another problem. That there are numerous problems. Basically, it's going to end up, however, that if we can't find a solution to the circulatory problem, which I've been involved in for the last 18 years in space, if we can't find a solution to the circulatory problems It isn't. We're not going to be able to give anything in space because the liver must metabolize it and the kidneys must excrete it. And so there's no way to get around it. And so I have, and I'm jumping the gun now, I've come to the conclusion that we're either going to have to duplicate exactly 1G, the same gravity force as on Earth, or we're going to have to use gene therapy. And I'll get into that at the end. There are 24,000 genes. I'm talking about perhaps starting with four, just four, and going from there. Okay, now...
Well, we're at the bottom of the hour, so this will be our point for our pause for our first break, and we'll come back, everybody, in about 2 minutes. So don't go anywhere. Dr. Rowe will be back 2 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
Welcome back, everybody. You are listening to our Monday Space Show program. Our guest, Dr. Bill Rowe. This is part one of a three-part special series that we're doing with Bill on, human factors, medical issues, all related to going into space, as well as our personal lives right here on Earth and connecting the dots between two. I want all of you to go to Bill's website, www.femsinspace.com, FEMSINSPACE. Scroll down on the left center part of the website. As you scroll down, you'll see the big words submarine. And Bill is currently talking about his submarine model, and you need to follow along. And the best way to do that is just to be looking at his website as we're talking. Okay, Bill, go for it. Oh, the phone number again, listeners, 1-866-687-7223. If you call, I'll bring you up and get you in as soon as possible. And if you're sending email, I'll probably hold you until we have pauses in Bill's discussion. So, Bill, take us back to the submarine.
All right, I want to start. The whole concept of this is to explain the various components which are basically related to oxidative stress. Now, if you look at the figure that I have of the submarine, I use the submarine again because I want to convey the idea that the lining of the blood vessels that we call the endothelium is very delicate, and all of us are exposed to this vulnerability every single minute of the day. Now, if you look at the submarine, the first thing that you notice that I want you to look at is the periscope. And the periscope, I have defined it as the cytokines. Now, cytokines are small proteins, or small peptides, rather, which are related to the immune mechanisms. And I'm going to use very, very few medical terms. I'll try to cut them down as much as I can. But I can't eliminate every single medical term. Otherwise, I wouldn't have anything to say. So just accept the fact that that you're going to have to be exposed to a few. The cytokines are small peptides, and they serve as a signal, just the way a periscope. If you see a periscope just protruding above the surface, you know you're in big trouble. Well, the same thing I want to convey with the cytokines. Big, fat people with big stomachs, especially males, have a manufacturing plant for cytokines. These cytokines are deadly. Why? Because they trigger oxidative stress. Now, I'll explain exactly what oxidative stress is this way. Look at the formula. Look at the figures inside the submarine, and look at the one is an, the first one on the left is an oxygen molecule. Now, most free radicals, and I'll explain to you what free radicals are, most of the ones that we're concerned about day in and day out are the ones that are derived from oxygen. Now, this is an example of an oxygen molecule. It has two atoms, and the two atoms each have four little dots, which are radicals, R-A-D-I-C-A-L-S, and these radicals are paired. They're in a pair. There's two in the top, two in the bottom on the left, two in the top, and two in the right on the bottom, and then there are four in the middle, and each atom shares the two from the other side. So altogether, each atom theoretically has eight electrons. Now, if there's a loss of one of those electrons, then you end up with a free radical that is called a superoxide anion. If you don't like the word superoxide anion, just use the letter A for anion, and that'll be good enough. I can't help the words. That's just the way it is. Now, look at the next one. The next one is also a free radical, and that is what is called a hydroxyl radical. Now, the hydroxyl radical is particularly of interest because that one is highly reactive and more dangerous than the superoxide anion, or what we'll call A. Now, if you look, and you can see, again, that both the superoxide anion and the hydroxyl anion have this single electron. In other words, the pair is no longer there. Now, nature has everything, nature doesn't have everything, but the male and female are in pairs. This pair bonding is extremely important among a male and female, not only for sex, but there was a recent article in the journal Science last week that pair bonding separates human beings from the chimpanzees. About 6 million years ago, we separated from the chimpanzees 6 million years ago, and one of the distinguishing features between us and the chimpanzees is the fact that we have what is called pair bonding, male and female, not only for sex, but to raise children and live in a unit of a male and female. Now, that if you want to remember something, keep in mind that males and females, not only for sex, but for the point that it distinguishes us from the chimpanzees, remember then that it's devastating if there's a divorce. The children are devastated, their lawyers involved, etc. The same thing with a pair of electrons. If one electron is gone and you have a single electron, that electron has a strong affinity for hydrogen. If there's enough water And therefore, H2O, enough hydrogen, that will solve the problem. That's why life cannot exist without water, because of hydrogen. That's why we're going to go to Mars. We're going to go to Mars only for one reason. Only for one reason, to find out if there is water. If there is evidence of water on Mars, this means that life probably exists all over the universe. There is no other way, no other reason to go there. Now, let's go on with the concept of oxidative stress. You hear this term, oxidative stress, over and over again, and I would say that 95% of the people listening to this right now have no idea what oxidative stress is involved. I told you already that most of the free radicals that we're concerned with are derived from oxygen. So you can understand right away that it's oxidative stress, and if there aren't enough antioxidants, and I'll explain that, if there aren't enough antioxidants to counteract oxidative stress, or to counteract the single free radical, then we call that oxidative stress. Now, free radicals are highly energetic fragments of molecules. They're produced when these are broken down by more extreme measures, such as very high temperature, for example, intense light or radiation. The free radical is really a molecular fragment left with a rogue, R-O-G-U-E, electron, which is, we use the word rogue electron because it causes all sorts of mischief. So remember that the body wants things kept in pairs just the way males and females are kept in pairs. The free radicals are highly oxidizing, which means that they have a very strong affinity for hydrogen, as I mentioned. They will readily strip hydrogen bonds, and they can strip molecules and cause a tremendous amount of havoc. They can break hydrogen bonds and damage DNA, and DNA is the stuff that our genes are made of. Now, I think that basically that's enough for oxidative stress. And if there are any questions, I'll stop right now.
Yeah, let me. This is by email again. And again, listeners, the toll-free number, 1-866-687-7223. Todd in San Diego says, is all of this applicable in spaceflight? Why are we talking about oxidative stress and free radicals? How does that enter into going to Mars, for example?
Well, I'll get into that. You're jumping the gun. I'm going to spend the next 5.5 hours talking about these problems. The basic, I'll just answer this quickly just to give you an idea. The vasculature is vulnerable on Earth, and the vasculature is far more vulnerable in space. And the present thinking is that it's an oxidative stress mechanism causing the problems with microgravity. When I might just briefly, very, very briefly, tell you how I got interested in all this. About 1995, I was invited to present a paper in China, in Canton, China, as a member of a fitness delegation. And I studied Cy Moll, who ran 524 marathons and was in the Guinness Book of Records, and Mary Hannadel, who was the 1987 Ultramarathoner of the Year, and both of them had evidence of damage to their blood vessels. And I postulated at that time that the damage to their blood vessels was related to extraordinary elevations of adrenaline, and we know that adrenaline can cause constriction of the blood vessels. And when there's constriction of the blood vessels, there's increased shear stress, and shear stress would be equivalent to two blocks of wood rubbing against each other, and also turbulence, which is just chaotic pressure movements in various directions. So that in itself can cause damage to the blood vessels. But in space, when I then shifted gears and when one, I was interested in finding out what happens in space, because I had read somewhere that astronauts might have to exercise as much as 4 hours a day. I thought, my God, if they have to exercise 4 hours a day, they're going to run into the same problems as my ultramarathoner who died 10 months after I studied him. And at autopsy at age 62, he had perfectly normal coronary blood vessels at autopsy at age 62, but he had damage to the heart muscle. Damage to the heart muscle, and yet the coronary vessels were perfectly normal, and I postulated that too much adrenaline can damage the lining of the blood vessels because of excess shear stress and turbulence, and published that in Lancet, and then from there I became interested in space. Now, in space, the endothelium, the lining of the blood vessels, is vulnerable also, but not only to shear stress and turbulence, but to a greater degree because of oxidative stress. And I just got through giving the definition of oxidative stress. And there are various factors in space which are conducive to oxidative stress. One is high adrenaline levels. When I gave a paper in 1995 in Toulouse, France, I had, after I finished my paper, stressing the fact that the adrenaline levels are elevated in space and cause all sorts of problems, an American stood up, who was involved with NASA, and argued with me vehemently that the adrenaline levels are not elevated in space. And a Russian, after she sat down, a Russian stood up, and she also argued with me. And I stood my ground, and the moderator said, well, Dr. Rowan, about 20 years from now, we'll find out if you were right. Well, about 7 years later, it was well accepted that the adrenaline levels are absolutely unequivocally elevated in space. And I drew my information from the Russians who had done work with experimental animals showing that the adrenaline levels are elevated in space, and there's no question about it. Well, with elevations of with elevations of the adrenaline in space, and with also a decrease in magnesium ions in space, with vicious cycles, the lower the magnesium, the higher the adrenaline, the higher the adrenaline, the lower the magnesium, this in turn is conducive to oxidative stress. Adrenaline can undergo what is called auto-oxidation. I wasn't going to talk about it, but I guess I might as well now. Adrenaline can undergo what we call auto-oxidation. It's readily oxidized by both hydroxyl radicals, and I explained to you with that submarine about hydroxyl radicals, and also these hydroxyl radicals are triggered by high iron. If you look underneath the hydroxyl radical on the submarine, you will see that with a decrease in magnesium, there is an increase in unbound iron, and that in turn causes oxidative stress. Now, what do I mean by unbound iron? The free iron is dangerous. Free iron is dangerous because of the so-called Fenton reaction, and some of you chemists might be interested in the fact that Fe2+ plus hydrogen peroxide yields Fe3+ plus hydroxyl radicals. So we're back to the hydroxyl radicals. If iron must be kept out of harm's way, otherwise you're going to end up with exactly what I've got here on the submarine, unbound iron, which is conducive to hydroxyl radicals. Now, iron must be bound to a protein to keep it in a bound state and out of harm's way. Well, the most important protein which is necessary to bind iron is transferrin, T as in Tom, R-A-N-S-F-E-R-R-I-N. I'm sorry, I can't help it to use these words, but that's the word that is used. And magnesium is very, very important for the synthesis of this transferrin. Magnesium is an antioxidant, and one of the most important reasons why it's an antioxidant is because it synthesizes proteins, and the one that it synthesizes and the one that's so important is transferrin. So I think that's enough to give you an idea that in space there is oxidative stress damage to the blood vessels. Now, if there are any other questions, I'll be glad to answer them before we go on.
Karen is in Las Vegas, and she said, if I'm understanding the oxidative stress correctly, instead of 4 hours of exercise, couldn't the astronauts do whatever exercise they do, but then set aside time for meditation to combat stress?
Oh, I'm so glad that someone asked me this. I have been involved in this research for 18 years, and after 18 years, I have no idea how to write an exercise prescription in space. I have no idea after 18 years, nor does anyone else. Now, one of David's guests, about 4 or 5 months ago, was Dr. Fitts, F-I-T-T-S. And his paper got a lot of play, and Dr. Fitts' paper showed that after 6 months in space, there is about a 25% loss of skeletal muscle in space, about a 25% loss of some skeletal muscle. These were skeletal muscles, certain skeletal muscles, not all the skeletal muscles of the body, but certain skeletal muscles of the lower extremities. And Dr. Fitts came to the conclusion that what the astronauts need is a better exercise prescription and perhaps possibly more exercise. Well, the reason that I got all excited about space 18 years ago was the fact that I'd come across a book written by Nicholas Booth, called Space the Next 100 Years, that in order to prevent loss of skeletal muscle and bone, astronauts in space would have to exercise 4 hours a day. Well, 4 hours a day of exercise with 8 hours sleep, any of you listening would absolutely go crazy unless you were crazy in the first place. Now, so because of this, I went over to Oslo, Norway, about 1997 or 1998, and I went over there specifically. First of all, I love to travel, so it gave me a great excuse to go to Oslo. And I went to see Dr. Carbonen, Dr. Rodahl, R-O-D-A-H-L, and he and Astron, A-S-T-R-A-N-D, wrote a marvelous physiology book back in 1986, and he's one of the world's leading authorities on exercise. And I said, what are we going to do? I just got through visiting Booth in London, and he is advocating exercising up to 4 hours a day. So he said, if you're going to sleep for 8 hours, that means you only got 16 hours left. I would think the best thing to do would be for an astronaut to exercise 15 minutes out of every hour. Well, who in the hell can stand to exercise 15 minutes out of every single hour for a round trip to Mars? And I'm telling you, after 18 years, I have no idea how to do it. The reason is because we have 1G genes, and we don't belong in space in the first place, and there's already evidence in rats that they're in trouble in 12 days to the lining of the blood vessels, and since we share 80% of the same genes as rats, I don't know how to write an exercise prescription.
Okay.
And if anybody can tell me, I'd appreciate it. So we're going to end up either with gene therapy or trying to duplicate exactly 1G, which brings up the next point.
Okay, but before...
Unless you got a question.
Yeah,
David.
I've got a caller on hold, so hold on. Caller, are you still with us?
Hi, yes, I am. Hi, this is Paul Dare, the Enterprise guy. I'm calling from England.
Hi, Paul. Welcome back to the show. How are you?
Hi, yeah, I'm well, thank you, and good to talk to you, and good to hear the show. Also, hi to Bill. Bill and I, as you just mentioned, have had a long correspondence on topics related to this, so he knows that I agree with him on many points and disagree with him on some. But I have one question, which perhaps I'll come back to again later in the series.
Okay, wait. He wants you to speak a little bit louder, so let's...
Yep, sure. Okay, sure. How, is that any better?
A little bit, yeah.
Okay. So my question really is this, and as I say, we may come back to this later in this series, but... So you've highlighted the fact that there are sort of serious medical issues beyond the simple sort of muscle wastage that happen on prolonged space missions. But one question I have is how early or how long an exposure to microgravity is necessary before you start to see any signs of these changes?
Well, I think that they can. We know that there's some skeletal muscle loss within 2 weeks. Within 2 weeks, there's some, and it's a progressive problem, but I've read the figure 2 weeks. We know that there's a loss of bone of 1 to 2% every month, every single month, and with skeletal muscle loss in about 2 weeks.
Okay, and how about the other metabolic changes that you've highlighted?
I'm sorry.
How about other metabolic changes that you have mentioned?
Oh, I can't tell you that. I don't know about the others. It's a marvelous question, and I don't know whether how carefully that's been investigated, Paul. You know, Paul, there are only 500 people who have been in space. Only 500. So we have a very, very limited number, and the problem is also that the investigators that want to share the equipment, and so because of that, we're very, very limited. And so I have to admit that some of this that I'm telling you is theoretical, but we have to do the best we can with what we're presented with. It'd be marvelous if we could do a study of 2,000 or 3,000 people to get out, come up with some answers. On the other hand, I'm very frustrated when I read a long paper and somebody just ends with the conclusion, we need more data. I think that somebody should just, I haven't been afraid to stick my neck out, and many, many people have argued with me. I don't know if I've answered your question, Paul, but that's the best I can do.
Okay, the reason I was asking that question is my understanding is that of the people who've spent significant amounts of time in microgravity, their responses to microgravity have varied. I mean, some have had serious health problems, and other people have had less serious problems, even though they may have been in microgravity for longer.
David, I'm missing what he's saying.
What he's saying is that of the people...
I just can't hear the words.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you fine.
All right, so what he's saying is of the people that have been exposed to microgravity, they have a varied response to it. Some are impacted much more than others and in different ways.
Certainly.
Okay, and that leads on to a second question, which is why I was asking about how quickly these problems show up. Because my suspicion is that the tolerance of microgravity is going to vary a lot between individuals. We're quite a diverse species. We have lots of variation. And the ideal solution, or at least one short-term solution, might be to be able to assess people for their long-term responses to microgravity based on a relatively short-term response. So, for example, if you could assess people for, let's say, 2 weeks in microgravity, that may be a way to pre-select candidates for a longer space mission.
Did you get that, Bill?
I missed the last...
Okay, so possibly because of the variations, if you had a way to assess people for their ability to deal with long-term microgravity based on the data from short-term microgravity assessments,
yeah,
then you might be able to pre-screen to have more suitable candidates.
Well, that's a good question, but I think to make predictions, there's so many variables involved that I think it would be very, very difficult to anticipate what might happen weeks or months ahead of time in advance based upon limited data from just a few weeks. I don't know if I've answered your question, but that's about the best I can do. There's so many variables involved and just the insult to the blood vessels alone, that I think it would be difficult to do that. I think you've got a good question, but I can't go any further, Paul.
Okay, no, that's fine. I think that's a good answer. I'm probably going to call back in later during your series. I'll probably have something to say about some of your more specific points later on. In the meantime, I really just wanted to say, you know, hi to David, hi to Bill. And if there are any Enprise teams out there listening, hi to them too. And I will wish you a successful show, and I'll probably speak to you again soon.
Thank you, Paul. I appreciate your calling in.
Well, thanks so much for calling. I appreciate it. It's an honor for me for you to call in.
Oh, no, the honor is mine, and I expect I'll speak to you again soon.
Thank you again.
Okay, all the best.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Listeners, we're going to take our next break. We're at the top of the hour. We'll come back in 3 minutes with segment 3 and Dr. Bill Rowe. Don't go anyplace.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of The Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And The Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. And welcome back, everybody. You're listening to our Monday Space Show program. This is our third segment with Dr. Bill Rowe, which is the first of a three-part series of programs we're doing. The next one will be Friday of this week and then the following week. And for those of you who want to call us, that line is now available again, 1-866-687-7223. Okay, Bill, back to the submarine.
Okay, I have skipped ahead, and I want to go back to number one, ischemia and reperfusion. Now, again, I'm sorry about a medical term, but ischemia, many of you who have had heart trouble and problems with your heart understand what the word ischemia means. All it means is that there's an imbalance between oxygen supply and demand. If the supply of blood is diminished, you're going to have ischemia. If the demand is too great, such as running against the cold wind, for example, you're going to have ischemia. Let me give you an example. Irwin, on Apollo 15, had all sorts of cardiovascular complications during the mission, during reentry, and demonstrated a few days afterwards, and I'll mention some more about that later. But during reentry at 7 Gs, I think the shuttle probably during reentry has only about 2.5 to 3 Gs at the most. But during the Apollo missions, the reentry levels were about 7 Gs. And during reentry, Irwin had classical angina, classical. He felt as if an elephant was standing right on his chest. And he was so short of breath, during reentry, which is, there is a radio blackout during reentry, but they make a recording during that recording of 4 minutes, Irwin described in his book, his autobiography, which was published about 1973, that he was so short of breath he couldn't say one word. So the demands were so great during reentry that he had ischemia, an imbalance between oxygen supply and demand. Now, when one has ischemia, this ischemia, imbalance between oxygen supply and demand, is followed by what is called reperfusion. In other words, the blood is again circulating following this ischemia. We call that reperfusion. It just reperfusion follows ischemia. But there is a price to pay for that reperfusion, because all of a sudden you're exposing the body following the ischemia to a sudden exposure of oxygen, and the body doesn't like sudden changes, and it reacts to it negatively. This may be one of the explanations as to why sometimes angioplasties, where you're just removing, you're just eliminating a clot in one of the blood vessels with a catheter, sometimes angioplasties don't work because of the price that is paid by reperfusion. Or sometimes bypass surgery doesn't work. A lot of times it may not work because of the problem with reperfusion suddenly providing oxygenated blood. Now, with a sudden exposure of to the body of reperfusion, you're exposing the heart not only to oxygen and the potential of oxidative stress, but at the same time, you have what we call calcium overload. Again, a medical term, but you all know what calcium is, and calcium in excess quantities can be devastating. Now, if there's a sudden input of calcium into the cells of a heart, there is the potential of damaging the machinery of a cell that we call the mitochondria. Again, I'm sorry about the medical terms, but you can just, we're talking about the machinery of the cell. And if an excess amount of calcium enters the machinery of the cell, and by the way, the mitochondria are also the source of free radicals all as well, this can cause damage to the mitochondria, the machinery of the cell, or cause the cell to die. Similarly, if you have a sudden reperfusion, this may cause an excess amount of calcium affecting the muscles, which provide constriction to the blood vessels. And these are smooth muscles, and if they're exposed to too much calcium, the vessels will constrict. So this is a problem, but what I'm concerned about, and what I have asked Paul, the guy who just called in a question, is what are we going to do in space with the oxygen, 100% oxygen, which is required prior to a spacewalk? Now, the same problem can occur with 100% oxygen as might occur with reperfusion. Prior to a spacewalk, for at least 2 hours usually, the astronaut must be exposed to 100% oxygen to prevent decompression sickness or the bends. This is a situation where there's an accumulation of nitrogen bubbles in the blood vessels, and this accumulation of nitrogen bubbles in the accumulation of nitrogen bubbles in the blood vessels can damage the blood vessels and can damage the muscle and can cause joint pain that we call the bends, or it can damage the lungs, the brain, or death. Now, supposedly, there has not been any problem with anyone developing decompression in space, decompression sickness in space, but I can say this because I'm not involved with NASA, that I don't completely trust NASA, and I'll go into this later. The fact that it hasn't been reported doesn't mean a whole lot to me, because I have had an experience where NASA has withheld information for 35 years from the public regarding Irwin and what his blood pressure was when he returned. But anyhow, as far as I know, there hasn't been any case published of decompression sickness, but the other problem might be that astronauts are not going to complain about problems they might have had, and they might not even, they might not complain, might not report that they had joint discomfort during a spacewalk, which might have been a reflection of decompression sickness. So the problem that bothers me is, what are we going to do about the necessity of 100% oxygen for at least, let's say, 1.5 to 2 hours prior to a spacewalk? Many people, and I shouldn't say many, but several people have argued with me that we have to do is duplicate exactly 1G on the moon or on Mars, and everything is going to be fine. Well, the problem is this, that if we duplicate, how are we ever going to explore Mars and travel, let's say, 10, 20, 30, 50, 100 miles from the site of landing to look for water? And that is going to involve inhaling 100% oxygen prior to putting on the space suit, and therefore the astronauts are going to be exposed, if they go day in and day out and day in and day out, for perhaps weeks or months. And if they can't tolerate 100% oxygen, then why send humans to Mars in the first place? Just send robots. So even Zubrin, who feels that we should have left for Mars at 4:30 yesterday afternoon, concedes the fact that we can duplicate, that we need to duplicate 1G en route to Mars and coming back. But how are we going to explore Mars? And if we do explore Mars, what are we going to do about the 100% oxygen? I think that someday some genius is going to find a way to prevent decompression sickness without the necessity of 100% oxygen, because 100% oxygen increases the risk of oxidative stress that I've talked about. Now, perhaps at that point I can stop and see if there are any questions.
You do have a question again, and this is Alice is in Tucson, Arizona. And Alice says, the fact that many people want to go to Mars, want to return back to the moon, that NASA has a human spaceflight program, you don't generally hear anything about this like you're talking about. So is what you're talking about documented within NASA and it just doesn't make it to the surface? Are you breaking new ground? What's the relationship between what you're talking about on the show as compared to the public literature that NASA has put out with the human spaceflight experience?
Well, I'm glad that, first of all, I get that question all the time. I have about 55 papers published, and about half of them are peer-reviewed. I've got about 30 papers as letters to the editor in Spaceflight Magazine, which are not peer-reviewed. But I've got probably at least 25 that are peer-reviewed. Now, when I get a peer-reviewed paper published involving space, it has to go through a space expert peer reviewer. And I could not possibly get published without going through a spaceflight peer reviewer. So all I can tell you is that somebody is paying attention to what I'm doing, or otherwise I couldn't get published. Now, your argument that no one is publishing this, NASA has published many, many articles about the problems involved to astronauts. They published a lot of them. You're just not familiar with them. I can't give you a quote right now off the top of my head, but NASA has published them. And here's an article published in right in front of me, published in Physiological research showing a permanent depression of two vessel dilators and clot busters during long-term space missions. I'd already told you about this. This was the astronaut who was up on Mir for 438 days, and after 5 months had his two vessels and dilator clotbusters. I'm just translating into plain English technical terms. These were not detectable. Well, this is one example of the fact that there are publications out there. You are just not familiar with them. There are many of them. There are many, many of them. You're just not familiar with it. I published back in 1996 or 1997, Interplanetary Travel and Permanent Injury to the Normal Heart. Interplanetary Travel and Permanent Injury to the Normal Heart, which was published in Acta Astronautica. Acta Astronautica is a space journal. It has to go through peer review. Now, when I sent that paper back in 1995, I didn't hear a thing for 6 months. Nothing for 6 months. And I was a little bit shy at that time. It's only the third paper I had ever written. And so I had my nephew call in to find out what was going on. I thought that if you call Paris, you have to know French. Well, anyhow, he called and found out, yeah, we haven't heard anything either. So it sent it to somebody else, and finally, after 20 months, it was published. But that took 20 months, and I didn't hear anything. The only thing that I know is that after 20 months, it went out there. So I think that you're not correct about making this statement.
About NASA not publishing on it.
Well, NASA has published also. NASA has published as well. NASA is absolutely, I'm convinced NASA's afraid of the taxpayer. So since NASA's afraid of the taxpayer, they don't publish things that should be. All right, let me give you an example right now, since you raised the question. NASA has kept for 35 years the fact that one of the astronauts came back from the moon, and that was Jim Irwin, with the most extraordinary stress test blood pressure that I have ever seen. I have monitored in Toledo, Ohio, a hospital-based electrocardiographic laboratory, treadmill laboratory, over 5,000 treadmill stress tests. And I have never seen the blood pressure that James Irwin developed after he came back from his space mission of just 12 days. The day after he came back, his bicycle stress test, after just 3 minutes, the blood pressure was over 275 over 125. Now, all of you should know that today, as of 2011, the resting blood pressure should be not over 130 over 80. If any of you have blood pressure over 130 over 80, even if you're 95, it's elevated. And on a stress test, even all the stress tests that I did, the 5,000, I took every single one of them. I tried to take them up to their maximum capability. I didn't stop at 85% of their predicted maximum. I took them up to their maximum, and I have never seen blood pressures to that level. Never. And NASA has kept that from the world for 35 years. I have Barry's paper right on my dining room table. And here's I'll read the sentence to you. NASA, this is a NASA publication by Barry called The Medical Legacy of Apollo. It was published in Aerospace Medicine in 1974 by Charles A. Barry, NASA Director of Life Sciences. Sentence, he's talking about the astronaut's blood pressure. Post-flight Apollo astronauts exhibited labile blood pressure for up to 3 days, again, with the exception of the Apollo 15 crew, for whom the recovery period was protracted. Now, did Barry mention what his blood pressure was? No. So for 35 years, the world has been denied the opportunity to do research to find out why the blood pressure was so damn high going to the moon.
So if NASA doesn't release the number, how do you get the number of what you said?
I got it through the Freedom of Information Act. I got it through the Freedom of Information Act about 4 years ago. And I received, through the Freedom of the Information Act, I wanted to get it on, I wanted to get that information on Irwin, because I knew that Irwin had many, many cardiovascular problems during reentry. He had angina, as I already told you. 21 months after Apollo 15, Irwin had the first heart attack and had three subsequently and died in 1991. 4 years ago, I requested from the Freedom of Information Act the cardiovascular data on Irwin during and after his mission. I received 55 pages from Irwin. I received 55 pages from NASA regarding Irwin, and 11 pages had no dates. Now, the fact that it had no dates, I guess I sound like I'm paranoid, but I think that the dates were missing because NASA did not want this published, and if you don't have a date, you can't get something published. Well, they were all related to the moon, and one of the dates, one of the sheets of paper contained the stress test on Irwin with a blood pressure of over 275 over 125, and obviously there's no way that it could have been before the mission because they never would have sent him. Irwin's blood pressure, by the way, at rest was elevated a month before Apollo 15. His blood pressure was 145 over 110 at rest before he a month before the Apollo 15 mission, and he really should have been rejected in the first place. But anyhow, I felt that the reason those dates were rejected were missing the dates because they didn't want that published, and there were no dates that could be published. Well, I published it anyhow, and I was furious. As a matter of fact, I was going to go on 60 Minutes. I had some friends talk me out of it. Probably I wouldn't get on anyhow.
I have an email question for you from Paul in the UK again. And he says, to what extent, Bill, do you think that physiological changes seen in astronauts are a result of microgravity as opposed to other factors such as stress in the psychological sense and workload? And are there comparable studies of people in similar situations, that is, confined environment, heavy workload, under normal G?
Oh, that's complicated. It's a complicated question, and I don't think there is any answer. There is no answer for this. The only thing that you're going to end up with a question like this is saying that yes, the adrenaline levels are invariably elevated, and yes, stress is a factor. But how to sort it out and tease out the information with various factors.
Hello?
I think it's impossible to give him an answer in that situation. I can't. There certainly are psychological factors. For example, we know that the average astronaut only gets 6 hours of sleep every night. Now, that is not related to anxiety. That's just a complication of microgravity itself. But because an astronaut gets only 6 hours of sleep at night, whereas everyone should have, if possible, 7.5 to 8 hours of sleep at night, that 6 hours is related partially to the adrenaline levels. The adrenaline levels are invariably elevated. The blood pressure at night should drop by 10%. And with astronauts, the blood pressure does not drop by 10% at night. And the reason it does not drop by 10% at night is because the adrenaline levels are elevated. The adrenaline levels are elevated possibly partially at night because of anxiety, but probably the major factor is because with space flight, with the lower the magnesium ion, the higher the adrenaline, the lower the magnesium ion. And magnesium is stored in the skeletal muscle and bone. About 60% of magnesium is stored in the bone, and about 40% of magnesium is stored in the skeletal muscle and in soft tissue. So that if the magnesium levels are low, and they invariably are, statistically significant, Carolyn Leach's book, which is a marvelous book published in 1998, she has shown that the magnesium levels are significantly reduced in space. The lower the magnesium, the higher the adrenaline. So Paul Deere has asked a question that really, I don't think there is any answer. You can't tease this out.
Okay. Bill, we're at the bottom of the hour. Again, we'll hold you over for one final segment to the top of the hour for a two-hour program today. So everybody stay where you are, and we'll be back with Dr. Rowe in about two-plus minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible.
Welcome back, everybody. We're in our fourth segment, and our guest today, Dr. Bill Rowe, part one of a three-part series. So, Bill, continuing on with your discussion, I know you want to bring to our attention the calcium-magnesium ratios.
Yeah, I want to try to weave back and forth space medicine with the problems of medicine on Earth, because I told David before I started this program that if I could get five people, to change their lifestyle based upon what I say today, after a year, if their lifestyle has been changed, and if they would send me an email, those five people, I would be satisfied with what I set out to do today, because I think that these take-home messages that I have related to the space program can be applied on Earth. And I'm going to go into insulin resistance either this time or next time, because it's a very, very common problem. But let me just address first the relationship between calcium and magnesium. All of you should consider strongly taking magnesium. And I think that it's been emphasized repeatedly that at least 60 to 70% of the population has a magnesium deficiency. And I have become very, very interested in it because invariably the magnesium levels are low in space, not only because the storage sites for magnesium in the skeletal muscle and bone are depleted, but also because there's invariable malabsorption, as I told you, and therefore whatever food you take containing magnesium might not be absorbed adequately. If one does not take enough magnesium, and in addition, if one is concerned, especially middle-aged or elderly people, about osteoporosis, the loss of bone, and therefore take a lot of calcium, they may get into trouble, a lot of trouble. Now, Mildred Seelig was my mentor since about 1990, and she died, unfortunately, 3 or 4 years ago. Mildred emphasized that one should not ingest more than a 2-to-1 ratio between calcium and magnesium, not more than 2-to-1 ratio, and I'll explain why in a minute. She emphasized, for example, that in Finland, Finland has the highest incidence of cardiovascular disease in the world, and guess what? Finland also has a calcium-magnesium ratio intake of 4-to-1. The problem is this. I've already alluded to that if there's ischemia, where there's an imbalance between oxygen supply and demand, and then that's followed by reperfusion, not only is there a sudden increase in the oxygen levels, but there is a sudden uptake of calcium into the machinery of the cells of the body, and then also into the skeletal muscle. Now, therefore, if one takes too much calcium, that availability of calcium will cause complications. So Mildred Seelig has emphasized that one should not take more than a 2-to-1 ratio of calcium to magnesium. Now, I published in the American Journal of Cardiology in 2006 in a letter to the editor emphasizing what Mildred has said based upon my criticism of an article that was published there. And I emphasize this, that if one takes a calcium-magnesium ratio higher than this, that it will cause a problem because you'll reduce the effectiveness of magnesium as an antioxidant, and that's the problem. And in addition, it should be emphasized that magnesium is just as necessary for osteoporosis as calcium is. The problem is that magnesium deficiencies are not recognized because the serum magnesium is not sensitive enough. It would be like testing your hearing based upon whether or not you can hear thunder. And that would be an extremely crude way of evaluating one's hearing. Well, the same problem exists with magnesium. 99% of magnesium is within the cell, and only 1% is in the serum. So when one has a serum magnesium level drawn and their serum magnesium quote is normal, end of quotes, that doesn't really mean that they don't have a deficiency. Whereas potassium level, the serum potassium level is far more accurate. And while we're talking about potassium, if one has a potassium deficiency, one might not be able to correct that potassium deficiency without their taking enough magnesium. So that should be kept in mind. And while we're talking about magnesium, let's talk about what foods contain magnesium. Dried fruit, prunes, apricots, things of that sort, legumes, which are beans, nuts, soy, those are all high, and I'm trying to think of a few more, but basically those are the ones that I can think of.
Oh, what about popping?
Dark leafy vegetables is another.
What about popping a pill?
What?
Popping
a pill. And then in addition, to take magnesium by tablet, and that should also be done. I would strongly recommend that one take magnesium citrate. Stay away from the magnesium oxide because magnesium oxide isn't absorbed well. But the magnesium citrate is well absorbed, and it's an excellent product to use. Now, what as far as dosage is concerned, do not, and I can't emphasize enough, do not take magnesium supplements unless you know that what your kidney function is. If you're an elderly person especially, then you may have impairment kidney function. All you've got to do is ask your doctor to get a serum creatinine, C-R-E-A-T-I-N-I-N-E. If the serum creatinine is normal, you don't have to have any other kidney tests, that's good enough, and just get that once a year. I'm going to have a physical tomorrow morning, I'm going to have a battery of laboratory studies, including a creatinine. And every year I get a physical, and every year all my laboratory studies are perfect, and I don't take any pharmaceuticals at all, nothing. So I've just been very lucky. It's not only the genes. I've walked and run and walked 56,000 miles since I was 40 years old. So part of it is, and I can tell you that the that genes did not carry me 56,000 miles. Now, what I would suggest doing is taking 200, if your kidney function is normal, taking 200 milligrams of magnesium citrate twice a day. We recommend that you take it twice a day because it's better absorbed that way than if you take it all at one time. It is very unlikely that it will cause diarrhea. A lot of people are concerned about taking magnesium because of that. I haven't had any problem with diarrhea with magnesium citrate, and don't take the oxide. There are other magnesium preparations, but that's what I would advise. And if you take calcium, I wouldn't advise taking any more than 500 milligrams. I don't take any. My wife does not take any. She's not allowed to. I don't permit her to take any. It isn't necessary if you're taking enough magnesium. A lot of people will disagree with that wholeheartedly. If they do disagree, I can't be dogmatic about anything I've said today. We don't have all the answers about anything. If you do take calcium, don't take more than 500 milligrams a day. If you get enough magnesium in your body, 500 milligrams of calcium will be enough. My mentor was Mildred Seelig, who wrote a book called The Magnesium Factor for the layman. The Magnesium Factor was published in 1954. Mildred was my mentor for 15 years. Mildred, at age 83, took no calcium whatsoever, none, because she was concerned about this calcium-magnesium ratio. Any questions?
Yeah, the ratio means so you'd take twice as much calcium as magnesium.
Right. In other words, we would recommend that you take two times as much calcium in your body as you take magnesium. That's enough, but don't take more than that. So I said that in my letter to the editor, if someone takes 1,000 milligrams of calcium a day, that they're going to have at least 500 milligrams of magnesium.
Magnesium. Okay.
Any questions?
No. Keep nothing that you haven't already covered.
All right. So I'm going to begin talking about insulin resistance a little bit. It's an extremely important subject, and I am very, very excited about it right now. Quite some time ago, I published an article about published an article which involved platelets, and I couldn't understand why the platelets were are reduced in space. And I asked Mildred. I used to call Mildred all the time to get advice from her, and she said that she thinks the most likely the reason that the platelets are reduced in space is because of clotting. Now, platelets are cells which are necessary for blood to clot. Your blood will not clot unless it has a sufficient amount of platelets. Usually a platelet count, the platelets are about 200,000, and if you're down in the 100,000 range or 75,000 range, you're going to be in big trouble because you're going to start hemorrhaging. And but invariably, there is a reduction in platelets in space, and I couldn't understand why. And the reason that it's so important is because platelets carry a growth factor. And I'll just abbreviate it because otherwise everybody will shut off their computer. We'll just abbreviate it VEGF. But anyhow, it's a growth factor, and platelets carry this growth factor. There was a letter to the editor in Lancet about 8 or 9 years ago emphasizing the fact that in space the platelets are diminished, and that would be the reason that this growth factor is diminished, because most of the growth factor is carried by the platelets. So if the platelets aren't available, then the growth factor isn't available, and if the growth factor isn't available, then in order for the body to build collateral circulation, it will not occur adequately unless the platelets carry this growth factor to the areas where it's needed. So that's a big problem in space. Now, this is very, very exciting to me because there. I just came across an article in Circulation, the journal Circulation. There are 50, there are 23,000 medically allied journals. 23,000, it's a little bit difficult to keep up with literature. There are 50 cardiology journals alone, and the most prestigious is the journal Circulation. And that journal came out, published an article about 3 weeks ago describing the problems with the fact that with diabetes, the platelets do not function properly. There is an excessive risk of clotting, and the reason is because the platelets stick together to an excessive degree, and also the platelets stick against the wall, the inside wall of the blood vessel, and this can cause obstruction of the blood vessels and obstruction of the circulation. So this is a real problem, and no one really knows why this occurs, but the fact is that because it does occur, it increases the risk of clot formation, and that in turn would interfere with circulation. So one of the reasons that diabetics probably often have a problem, if they've had diabetes for a while, of losing a foot or losing a leg or losing both legs, is because they have an excessive amount of clotting. That's of concern because invariably in space there is insulin resistance. Insulin does not function properly. When we use the word insulin resistance, we mean that someone has a high blood sugar and they also have high insulin levels, but the insulin isn't effective. It's not effective, and 90% of people who have diabetes really have what we call insulin resistance type. It's type 2, as opposed to type 1 diabetes, where someone has an autoimmune problem and the insulin doesn't function properly, and this begins much earlier in life. But adults very often have 90% of them have what we call insulin resistance. Unfortunately, with the amount of obesity which we have all over the world, more and more people have insulin resistance now, and this is a problem of considerable concern because now instead of adults developing insulin resistance, children are developing insulin resistance in their teens, and this was unheard of 50 years ago.
So if you are insulin resistant on Earth and you go to space, does that compound the problem?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, nobody's going to send you in space.
Well, what about a space...
Unless you're a space tourist.
I was going to say,
and
yeah.
We're going to talk about space tourism, I guess, next time or the time thereafter. I want to get into space tourism. I got a lot of ideas that I want to get across about
okay.
that. But let's save that for another time, David.
Okay, well, yeah, especially since your time is coming up short now. We don't want to start another topic in that sense. Theoretically, NASA or somebody would screen, and if you're insulin resistant, that would be a disqualification for going into space.
Absolutely. It's going to be darn hard to find a candidate that really is completely healthy. I don't really know how you're going to find one out. Coronary artery disease, I just got through saying, is so extremely common with one of the three major coronary vessels not uncommonly occluded in the early 20s. And this is why, from the beginning, I have felt that we should have females in space, and I think it's ridiculous to send a male into space. Now, I understand that every single male is going to say this guy is nuts, but it just doesn't make any sense. Let's look. I'll talk about this more in detail later. Let me just. I'll talk about estrogen later, and I'll talk about magnesium levels in females later. Let me just tell you one thing. As to why it doesn't make sense to send a male let's say to Mars. It doesn't make sense. One human being for 1 year requires how many pounds of food, water, and oxygen. David, do you want to answer this?
I don't know the answer, but men require a lot more than women.
Right. Men require a lot more. 10,000 pounds is required of oxygen, food, and water for one human being for 1 year. And it does not make any sense to send a strapping, strong man under the age of 28 to Mars. He's got to be under 28 to Mars, whereas you can send a female who can do every single thing that a male can do except have children by oneself. Otherwise, it makes no sense to send males. So I think that probably most people think that that Betty Rowe is the person who has developed this Friends in Space, but I happen to be a male, but I'm using my head.
So does the female require 10,000 pounds as well?
Yes, they would. So if you're going to use 10,000 pounds, I can't tell you, the difference, but I'm sure the requirements for food and water and oxygen, that's a theoretical.
Okay,
Bill. Anyhow, the requirement for food, water, and oxygen is going to be less in a female than male, and if it's 9,000 or 11,000, whatever.
When I was younger and an active scuba diver all over the world and in good condition, a comparable conditioned man and woman of approximately the same age diving as buddies, so they were doing exactly the same thing underwater, the female would end up with 20% more air in her tank when the guy had to surface.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it?
And that was across the board all the time. It was a given that women are far more efficient breathing, or whatever the process is, machine, underwater, as long as everything is pretty much a quid pro quo. So obviously, if you have a really poorly conditioned woman and an athlete guy, that doesn't hold true.
Right.
Or if you have a 70-year-old guy diving with a 20-year-old woman, that doesn't hold true.
Yeah.
But as long as everything is like comparable, I can't tell you how many times I would be diving on these trips and I would be buddied up with a woman approximately my same age, and I would have to surface and she would have 10, 15, 20% more air left in her tank.
Yeah, that's interesting. Very, very interesting. It just you just are agreeing with what I'm saying.
And everybody knew that. I mean, this is in the 70s and 80s,
yeah.
But I seriously doubt that it's any different today.
Yeah. Well, if I've discouraged a lot of people about Mars, I've just told it the way it is. A lot of people don't agree with me. I understand. And the other thing is that I guess I should apologize. Let me close by saying this. I have met some wonderful people who are with NASA. I have visited a group down at Johnson Space Center that are just outstanding. NASA has made a marvelous contribution, but so have the Russians. The Russians have made a tremendous contribution as well. And I don't want to give you the idea that I'm against NASA. I just am very, very upset as to why this was kept, this information that I gave you was kept from the world for 35 years. And the reason is what happened was that NASA averaged Irwin's blood pressure instead of publishing the fact that the blood pressure was so extraordinarily elevated. They just glossed over it and said that it was averaged, and that has missed the point of the whole problem. But again, I emphasize, NASA has made a tremendous contribution to the space program. We couldn't exist without it. Our exploration of to the moon was one of the great explorations of the century. Absolutely no question about it. And NASA deserves the credit for all of it.
Bill, people can email you, get a hold of you if they want to have a discussion. How do they do that? I know they can comment on the Space Show blog, but what's the easier way for you?
You can tell them to send me the address is right on there. There's one address on there.
On your website.
On my website down at the bottom.
Okay. So you can
Send me an email. I'd love to. I would hope that 5 years from that 1 year from now, I'll have five people, just five, send me an email in a year that that what I have said today has favorably affected your lifestyle. I can tell you that the research that I have done has had a tremendous impact on the way I eat, the way I live, the way I attempt to sleep 8 hours every night. It has influenced me tremendously.
Okay, you're next up for Friday of this week.
All right.
And we come in for part two. So, listeners, stay with us. And part two is Friday, as I said. And I will have this up on the archives later today. There are a lot of complicated terms in here. You may want to listen to all or parts of the program again to either take notes or to understand better what Dr. Rowe was talking about. And again, his website, FEMS, F-E-M-S, in space, I-N-S-P-A-C-E, one word, .com. You can see his submarine model there. You can find his papers there under articles. You can see the papers that he's been talking about today. And, of course, you'll find his contact information as well. And then, listeners, tomorrow night we have our regular show, and we're going to be talking about our connection between inner space and outer space with Guillermo, who was also the founder of the Space Angels Network, or one of the founders of the Space Angels Network. Back with Dr. Rowe on Friday. Thank you all for listening to this Space Show program.